Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
Welcome to my Book of the Week. This week, I'm joined down the line from Washington by the writer and critic Elaine Showalter, who will be talking about her new history of American women writers, A Jury of Her Peers. It's a book that provides a refreshing and sadly timely counterblast to the apparently widely held belief that the golden age of American fiction ended with the death of John Updike. Welcome, Elaine. Do you believe in the idea of a golden age?
I do believe in the idea of a golden age. I think there are probably more than one, but I don't think that having a golden age means that the next one is the tin age, you know, or that you can't go on even to a platinum and a diamond age.
But most of the people who are cited as the cornerstones of the golden age are all men, aren't they?
They are. And I think this is not a function of the quality of the literature. It's a function of a contemporary age of celebrity, of branding, of a certain expectation that works by men are going to be big novels, whereas works by women are going to be personal and domestic. I think it's very much what readers bring to the books and not what the books themselves provide.
Now, this is the first time that anyone has attempted to write a full literary history of American women writers.
Yes, why? It's amazing.
Why has that taken so long?
Well, for a long time, no one thought it was worth doing. It just wasn't important. Women writers, as one of my favorite critics says, entered American literary history as the enemy. They were writing the trashy bestsellers. They weren't worth the time and attention of serious scholars. And then when it became clear that there was a substantial literary tradition of American women writers, and when feminist critics began to take them seriously, the academic establishment began to question the intellectual validity of literary history. Could you do both literature and history justice? Feminists wanted to say, was there any way to be objective, or was making the choices that literary history required simply buying into some sort of patriarchal hierarchy, which they now wanted to completely destroy? So there were changes in the temper of the times that made it impossible, once people saw that there was a tradition, made it impossible to take it up.
But you wrote a book about English women writers back in the 70s, didn't you? So you're a latecomer. You're a slouch as well in coming to this subject.
Well, when I wrote about English women writers, I was writing about them from a feminist point of view, which was new, but there was nothing that was considered problematic about taking up this subject. And of course, one of the reasons that as an American, I began my scholarly career working on English women novelists was that they did have a tradition. You didn't have to apologize for being interested in Jane Austen or George Eliot. You didn't have to say, well, I realize they're not very good, but you know, I just want to do this for my own little domestic hobby. But with American women writers, this is still a case that has to be made. You have to justify the intellectual validity of working on this topic. And so I always thought I would write this book, and finally just said to myself, it's now or never, and I've got to take it up.
It's full of lovely anecdotes. Well, why don't we just start with the title of the book, A Jury of Her Peers. Tell us where that comes from.
A Jury of Her Peers is the title of a short story by Susan Glaspell, who was a Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright of the same generation as Eugene O'Neill, and in fact, by many of her contemporaries, was considered to be better than Eugene O'Neill. She wrote this story, which was based on an experience she had as a young journalist in the Midwest, covering a murder trial of a woman who had killed her brutal husband. And in the short story, there is a woman on an isolated farm who was accused of murdering her husband, and the sheriff and his deputy and their wives have come out to the farm for the men to look for clues. The men can't find any clues. They are looking for a gun, a smoking gun, big, obvious things. But the women read all the details of the domestic environment, and they conclude between themselves that this woman had been abused, that she was desperately lonely, that she had cracked, and that in a kind of moment of mad rage had killed her husband. And because they feel responsible for her loneliness and isolation, they feel guilty themselves that they haven't reached out for her to help her, they destroy the evidence so that she can't be convicted of the crime. So it's a story that's quite a classic story and very rousing from a feminist point of view. You know, hooray, they've prevented her from being convicted. But at the same time, you could say that in preventing the case from coming to trial, they have made it impossible for the woman's story to be heard by an audience at large. They've protected one woman, but at the expense of many women who might have similar experiences. And it's the law that needs to be changed. So that's my idea in the book, that we need a jury of literary peers, not just women, not just clones of women writers, but serious, attentive, informed readers. And we need the case to be argued out in the open with lawyers for both sides, because it's the literary laws that have to be changed, not a single woman who needs to be acquitted.
Mm. Now, women have conspired in their own oppression to some extent, haven't they? For example, in the invention and use of pseudonyms to disguise their true identities.
Yes, but, you know, it's very different with American women writers. It's quite exceptional for American women writers to use the male pseudonym, which was not only the standard in Britain in the 19th century, but in fact all over Europe. But American women had the idea that as daughters of the Republic, daughters of a democracy, they could appear as women and get a fair treatment, and they were wrong. So they used either their own names, or when they use pseudonyms, they use feminine pseudonyms. They don't conceal their sex, and I think that actually cost them.
And such as, for example, Fanny Fern, who was into alliteration, wasn't she?
Well, not only alliteration, but these sort of floral, hyper-feminine names, which became a vogue in the middle of the 19th century. And it was almost to say, here I am, I'm so feminine that you can't possibly accuse me any more than I've already accused myself. They were actually rather tough and prickly writers. They were very thorny, not ferny at all. But they did not launch themselves as writers who wanted to be taken seriously as artists, which George Eliot and the Brontes did.
And at the same time, they had Nathaniel Hawthorne describing them as a damned mob of scribbling women.
He did. Hawthorne was extremely hostile to the women writers of his day, which was to say the 1850s, a great age for American writing, men and women both, because he thought that they were taking his market. They were writing huge bestsellers, which he assumed had to be trash, whereas he saw himself as the model for the American male artist, the martyr to excellence, to the muse, who couldn't make a living because these commercial women were taking all the space.
So how many of these earlier writers are actually worth reading today?
I think if we look at, let's say we say early is before 1900, I would say probably about 20 really could have a significant audience today. That's quite a lot, I think. And American writing, unlike British writing or perhaps European writing too, I think does evolve and progress. I mean, America began with a lot of limitations and a lot of disadvantages as a literary environment. And I think it did take a while for the literature to evolve. And I think also because of the pressures of Puritanism in America, that a great deal was repressed, a great deal was forbidden and ruled out. And it took a while, really until the 20th century, for American women especially to have access to even a significant percentage of the territory that men had claimed. So the early writing does labor under some disadvantages, and even so, there is some astonishing writing which deserves to be much better known and which I think people would find not only absorbing but really thrilling.
Do you want to name check a couple of people that we should be looking
well, up? Yeah, one of the people that I think is just astonishing is Mary Rowlandson. Mary Rowlandson was one of the very first Americans and one of the first women to publish in the New World. She only wrote one book, which was a memoir of her captivity by Narragansett Indians. She was held hostage along with her three children for a period of several months and taken on a forced trek. And because of this traumatic experience, she felt justified in writing a narrative of her experience. It is just amazing. This woman was a born writer, and the story is tremendously exciting and harrowing, but it also really foretells the way American literature was going to develop, because long before male Puritan writers were engaged with this subject, she was dealing with the whole cultural element of the New World, which was the English settlers coming over and sharing the land with the Native Americans and finding some accommodation, having this clash of cultures out of which something, some kind of new lifestyle had to be developed. And she writes about that with tremendous observational wit and poignancy. So that's a terrific book, Memoir of Her Captivity.
You do nevertheless say that Kate Chopin's novel, The Awakening, which was written in 1899, was the first novel by an American woman that was completely successful in aesthetic terms.
Yes, it's I think, a perfect novel. Chopin was influenced particularly by Maupassant. She was reading Flaubert. She was aware of issues about European fiction. And it is an exquisite short novel. It's just beautifully crafted, extremely sophisticated, with the kind of art that very few American women writers had attempted outside of the short story. And she had it at novel length and manages, what by contemporary terms we would consider almost a modernist text.
You're not so fulsome about all the writers you talk about, are you? I mean, you give very short shrift to poor old Gertrude Stein.
Well, I don't know how poor and how old she was, but I am not very sympathetic with Stein. I thought it was very important in doing a book like this to be able to say what I really thought and to get away from the pressure of certain kinds of received opinions and literary expectation, and not simply to say, yes, well, we know these are the great women writers and these are the not so great. So I've tried to be open to a lot of women writers who are much less well known or who are even stigmatized for writing bestsellers, God forbid, and to look with a very unjaundiced eye at people like Gertrude Stein, who's had a very central place in modernist literary history. Now, she was self-promoting. She certainly was very productive. She had a good eye for the art of her time. But I think as a writer, she's really quite dreadful. And I don't think her experiments with prose and poetry had very much influence on other women writers of her time at all. I think her influence on 20th century literature is much exaggerated. And so I just sort of have to say this is a case where the Empress has no clothes.
Now, I imagine that there'll be a lot of people who'll be sort of scratching their brains to think of all the people you've left out. And in fact, we had a letter at The Guardian in response to your article saying, what about Donna Tartt? Have you had a lot of this?
I have had quite a bit of it. I can't remember. I think Donna Tartt maybe is mentioned in the book. And I like Donna Tartt very much. I don't think Donna Tartt is written enough. She's very, very slow writer, as you know. And I thought with her first book that she was extraordinarily talented. I'm eagerly awaiting everything that she does, but I don't think she's quite established herself among the very, very top rank yet. But there, I say in my piece for The Guardian that I made a list and I stopped at 50 contemporary American women writers who I thought were worth talking about, who had accomplished something. So there are a lot, and it is really surprising that they don't get the attention either individually or as a kind of generation that they deserve to have.
Yeah, our listeners can look at The Guardian for the 50 that you talk about and the eight contemporaries that you nominate particularly. But I would like you to name four women throughout the history that you really must read in order to get a sense of the contribution that American women writers have made.
Well, you have to start with Harriet Beecher Stowe. Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin is justly famous as the novel that started the Civil War. It is also a great novel. It was read all over Europe. It was read by Tolstoy. It was read by Dickens. It was read by Charlotte Bronte. It was read by George Eliot. It was read by Balzac and George Sand. It is a great work of art, and I think it has suffered for being such a political novel as well, and for dealing with the very troubled issues of race and slavery. So you have to begin with Stowe, who wrote many more novels, all of which are really terrific and deserve to be republished and reread. After Stowe, and we've mentioned Kate Chopin already, an astonishing writer at the end of the 19th century is Grace King, who was a Southern writer, contemporary of Chopin's, and who wrote short stories and novels about black and white women in the Deep South after the Civil War that are very subtle and very sophisticated and complex. They're really symbolic stories about women, particularly black and white women, their relationship, their cultural relationship, their heritage, their mutual enmity and love. They're very, very powerful stories, so I would list them as being important. A writer of the 1920s who's been ignored, I think, is Dorothy Canfield Fisher. The novel by Canfield Fisher I like particularly is called The Homemaker. It came out in 1925, and it's about a couple who are really both breaking down because they are trying to observe proper sex roles in their marriage, and neither one of them can bear it, and each one of them, in the mother in her way, the father in his way, are just coming apart. And he has a terrible accident, and they're forced to change places. And the novel explores the results of that. And it's not a comic novel. It doesn't take this as a sort of Disney switcheroo comic plot. It takes it very seriously. And it's prophetic. It's eloquent. It's really quite amazing. Canfield Fisher, who had a PhD in French from Columbia, so is also a very highly learned woman.
And finally, number four.
Finally, number four. And I'm leaving out writers like Toni Morrison, Edith Wharton, Willa Cather, writers who I think probably Guardian readers will already know. But number four, I would pick Gish Jen, who I talk about in the Guardian essay, as exemplary, not only a wonderful writer in for her own work, but exemplary of this whole generation now of, what should we call them, post-multicultural, post-immigrant, post-hybrid American writers. They are writers whose families came from someplace beyond the United States, whether it's Asia or Africa or Eastern Europe, but they are writing about their view of the American experience, not as sort of split personalities, but as observers creating a new America. She's very funny, full of surprises, and just a wonderful writer who should be much better known in the UK.
Elaine Showalter, thank you very much, and I look forward to following up your suggestions.
Thank you.